TFMR. It's Thursday. It is 11 o'clock Eastern time, and that means it is time for A to A. This is Access to Access. This is your webinar that gives you the opportunity to pose questions for some of the movers and shakers in the precious metals industry. And today we've got a new guest. This is someone that I have become familiar with via Twitter. He's got a great Twitter feed, diverse, full of great information. And as I learned more about him, I thought this is somebody we need to bring on. I'm talking about Simon Mikhailovich. His actual job, he's managing director at the Tocqueville Bullion Reserve. And we'll tell you what that is in just a second. But he kind of runs with some of the same crowd that we do. In fact, he was involved most recently in a fabulous documentary presentation that Grant Williams put together at Real Vision. It featured some of our good friends like Ronnie Sterfala and Ned Naylor Leyland, and Simon was on there too. And I, of course, invite everybody to check that out. But I want to introduce Simon today and get everybody a chance to get familiar with him and learn a little bit more about bullion reserves. So Simon, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Sure, thank you for having me.
Hey, all right. So before we get started, like I said, you can be found on Twitter, so people should follow you on Twitter. But to tell everybody a little bit about Tocqueville Bullion Reserve, because I know a lot of folks are familiar with John Hathaway, and you work with him there. But tell us about the company and what you do and what makes it different.
Sure. Tocqueville Bullion Reserve, John Hathaway is my partner. It's an independent affiliate, I guess, of Tocqueville. That is in the business of helping people purchase and store physical bullion, primarily in diversified overseas locations. People choose where they want it stored. It's a fiduciary vehicle, unlike most solutions of this type are offered by various vendors and brokers that sell gold and then help one store gold. And we are fiduciaries. So the difference between fiduciaries and brokers is the same as between stockbrokers and money managers. So if you have a manager, he owes you a duty to do the right thing and to use the best service providers in delivering a service to you for a fixed fee. Whereas if you're dealing with a broker, then of course, just like in real estate and in securities, the broker provides a similar service, but the broker is on the opposite side of the transaction and gets compensated from the volume and transactions as opposed to from a fee with all the other transactions being at the wholesale cost. So that's the essence. It's a structure, in addition to this, it's a legal structure that is used by thousands of funds. We picked it because it's ubiquitous. It's very well understood. There are a lot of service providers that service these the independent fiduciary, also fiduciary administrators, and we use one. So when we send a statement that says, you know, this is how much gold one has, it's not really, we are sending the statement. It's the independent administrator who sends the statement and who keeps the books. So it's, you can call it triangulation. In other words, different people are responsible for different things. So one person is not doing the same thing and telling you this is what you own, and I'm telling you that this is what you own because I'm telling you this is what you own. So we feel that from a control environment, it's a much more robust way of doing things. And finally, it's a legal structure that enables, that sort of combines things that are very difficult to combine, and that is compliance, fiduciary controls, and discretion, because it's private. And because thousands of other funds that do normal investing use the same structure, and this just looks like every other one of them. So it's an ability for people to own physical gold in different locations around the world whilst being fully compliant with the U.S. laws and regulations. Proper reporting and everything. But at the same time, they have ability to redeem their gold in cash or in kind on 24 hours notice. There really isn't a structure like that out there. I mean, a lot of people do similar things, but none of them does it quite this way.
Right, right. And where there are vaulting locations around the world, you said, what are some of those places, Simon?
The places that we use are that we offer are Singapore and Switzerland. And okay. The reason they were picked is not because of their safe havens, which they are, but it's mostly for a different reason. I mean, if you were to own a physical asset, any physical asset that needs to be delivered physically to market when you want to sell it, I think it makes sense to store it in a place where you can deliver it across the street as opposed to across half the world through customs and borders. And so it so happens that Switzerland, Singapore, and of course also Dubai and Hong Kong are very deep and vibrant bullion markets, mm-hmm. Commercial bullion markets that are not based on banks, like London Market, for example. And so it makes sense to store bullion, we feel, in proximity to places where there are multiple liquidity options. Because to the extent gold is stored as a liquidity reserve, I mean, you want to be able to access as many alternative sources of liquidity as you can with as little delay and, you know, obstacles as possible. And that we feel that that's what does it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We also have U.S. storage, by the way. Sorry. We also offer storage in the United States, although not too many people choose it.
And just to make sure I've got the clarification, will you go purchase gold for somebody, or is it just simply for a reserve for someone to store their existing gold?
No, it's organized as a partnership. And there are legal and compliance reasons for why that's done. Yes, as soon as we get the money, we go buy the gold the next day. And then 99.8% of the partnership is in gold at all times.
Got it.
So,
well, it's an interesting story. Like I said, when we first spoke, I thought that's an interesting structure, and that is unique. It's different from, gosh, all the other companies that we know of. And so I encourage everybody to check it out. There's a link on this page to bullionreserve.com. And like I said, Simon has proven to be a guy that pays attention to a lot of stuff around the world and a lot of the inputs and factors that move the gold price. And so I thought it'd be fun to have him on. And Simon, let's just start with, first of all, let's start with something that's kind of in the news today. And that's this imposition that President Trump is about to have or about to make of tariffs on steel and aluminum. A lot of concerns about whether this will set off a trade war around the world and what that could do to the global economy. I mean, I just thought I would start there to see if you have any opinions on how this might play out.
Well, as we discussed before we started this broadcast, the problem with predicting things or assessing their implications in this environment is that the environment is really unique. So I always find it funny when people say in the first sentence that we are in uncharted waters, and then to proceed to explain precisely what they think is going to happen next. Well, I mean, if you're in uncharted waters, you don't have a map.
Good point. Yeah.
Right. So the last it's not the last time, but you know, everybody knows that imposition of tariffs was a major contributor to the troubles of the 1930s and the Great Depression. You know, clearly it's not a positive in a sense that it creates a company. I mean, imposition of tariffs does a number of things. Of course, the point is to protect domestic industry. So we're talking about steel and aluminum in the first place. In this case, I'm sorry. But the implications are complicated. The United States doesn't produce a lot of things at home. So when we're not nearly as many things at home as it used to. So when you impose these types of tariffs, it's meant to help domestic industry. But of course, what it's going to do is, because a lot of the goods come from overseas, it's going to drive the cost of those goods up. And the idea is that the domestic industry can then ramp up and compete effectively through substitution effect. You know, so instead of buying something from China that's now 25% more expensive or 20% more expensive, a domestic company can make the same product and sell it for, 5% or 10% less than now the new price for the Chinese product. And that's going to help create jobs in the United States. The problem, of course, is that a lot of stuff comes from other places. And when it comes from other places, now it's going to be coming into the United States at higher prices. So I have to wonder whether there is ability on the part of the U.S. industry to ramp up, you know, massive production like we had 30 years ago, 50 years ago, mm-hmm. Overnight or in any reasonable time frame for this effect to take place in time to prevent rise in inflation. I mean, in the short term, it should raise the prices on everything because we buy the stuff from overseas and now the stuff's going to be more expensive because of the tariffs. So is it going to stimulate domestic industry? Okay, maybe, but when is it going to happen? Is it going to be 2 months, or is it going to be 2 years, or it's going to be 10 years? I don't know. So it's very difficult to say, but it's inflationary. That's in the short term, it's inflationary.
So that kind of ties into, I guess, in a sense, my second question. Do you think, Simon, this is kind of done in conjunction? Because I have felt like since the beginning of 2017, I mean, you recall, I mean, when Trump was elected, the narrative suddenly became, King Dollar, and we had that Economist magazine covered, with George Washington flexing his muscles and all that stuff. And the dollar, of course, proceeded to fall 10% last year, and it's already down about 3% year to date here in 2018. And I've thought on several occasions and stated often, that, I mean, they say you don't want to fight the Fed, but you don't want to fight the Fed and the president at the same time. I mean, they seem to both want a weaker dollar. I mean, could this tariff idea, if they're, if the Fed is trying to spark inflation, desperately, it seems trying to spark inflation. And now all of a sudden Trump wants to institute tariffs, which would then be inflationary. Do you think they're kind of in cahoots together trying to spark some inflation here to as a final straw to kind of get what they want?
I again, as we briefly discussed before we started, I have honestly given up on trying to predict these things. The reason I have is because I've come to the conclusion that the wisdom of the ages, in circumstances when you are out of balance and you have no maps to follow. I mean, what do you have to fall on? I mean, you have to fall on on history, and I don't mean the last 20 years worth of history or the last post-war history. I mean history throughout history. History is cyclical, so there are different parts of the cycle throughout history, and some of these cycles last a lifetime. So you can't go back through a personal experience and say, well, the last time this happened, this is what it meant, because there are other precedents under different environments where things happen. So what I'm leading up to is there's a book called The Art of War that was written by Chinese philosopher Sun Tzu hundreds of years ago, where there's a great line that I think applies here, and that is, strategy without tactics is the longest path to victory. Tactics without strategy is the noise before defeat. Now,
I like that, yeah.
the implication of this is, if you have the strategic picture correctly, even if you don't correctly execute tick for tick, you will get to the place where you need to go, even though it may not be the shortest way there. If you are not seeing the bigger picture, if you are just simply executing, even correctly, from tick to tick, this is just the noise before you lose all your money. And I think that that is a, well, I've concluded that. I'm not saying that everybody should do that or everybody should conclude that, but I've concluded that I do not have ability, despite being in this business for 35 years, to correctly predict what is going to happen tick for tick, because of the differences and because of the unique situation on many fronts that we're in. And if you look at the performance of the hedge fund community over the past couple of years, which has dramatically underperformed the market, you would probably conclude that smart people or intelligent people are somehow missing what's going on. And the reason is because the paradigm has changed, because it's impossible to predict these things. So the dollar is, first of all, when you say the dollar is stronger or weaker, that specifically means that the dollar is stronger or weaker versus other fiat currencies, which are just as furiously conducting unconventional monetary policies as the United States. And so who is more radical at any given moment? Who is injecting money? Who is holding back money? Who is doing what is what's driving these moment-by-moment fluctuations? But if you step back, or if you step many steps back, the strategic picture is completely different. They're all go it's a race to the bottom. All these currencies are going down together over time because the debts are impossible to meet in real money. If the crisis of 2008 was about too much debt, then there's 40% more debt than there was then. And there's more leverage, meaning that the debt to GDP ratios are higher than they were before. I think the balance sheets of central banks have expanded by something like eight some trillion dollars, but the GDP has only added $2 trillion over that time. So $6 trillion is basically gone into the securities markets. And so you're watching a massive cash inflow effect. And the inflation that everybody is looking for in consumer, for which everybody is looking in consumer prices, is raging in asset prices. So it's just, it's different this time. It's different and it's not different. It's every situation has its own unique sort of features, and we're, it's difficult to recognize them.
Right. Well, and to that end, it does make, like I said, like you said, the tick for tick stuff will drive you crazy. And I think everybody listening to this will, I think it's funny how many times I've said that myself in the last 6 or 8 months that I've, you know, you got to try to ignore this tick for tick noise because it'll drive you crazy. If we've got the general trend right, if we're right, you know, if our logic is correct about where all this is headed, you don't want to get yourself, turn yourself broke, and you don't want to freak yourself out between now and then following the tick for tick. And, but I do want to, you know, if it's okay, I just want to ask you what you think. I guess the final question I had, before we get some of the listener questions and some of the questions that have been emailed in, what do you think of the current situation? Because there's so many people with so many varied opinions about how many times the Fed's going to hike rates this year, and then ultimately what that does to long-term rates and what long-term rates might do to the economy, and then what might happen from there, and do we eventually get back to cutting rates and more QE, and what does that do for gold? I mean, what is your general opinion about where this is all headed in the months ahead, Simon?
I think that we are in a in an epic bubble in financial assets. Some call it the everything bubble.
Right.
It is a, it is, now, you know, there's no harm or shame in calling things the way they are, even though sometimes these names evoke meanings and emotions that are not necessarily appropriate. So people say, you know, when you say there's an everything bubble, it's going to burst and financial system is going to have to be reorganized. The debts are going to have to be reorganized. There's no really way to fix this without completely, you know, massive wealth transfer. So people immediately jump and say, well, this is doomsday talk. That's because in the last 35 years, it's been a one-way ride.
Right.
In the last 35 years, interest rates went down and asset prices went up. And all things being equal, which in economies, in economics, how they do it, even though in real life, that's not, it's never quite like that. But, you know, if you just isolate the interest rates and the asset prices, there's a formula, present value formula, that is the linchpin in all models that are used to value all financial assets, real estate, stocks, bonds, everything. The danger here, or what people should really focus on, is this. What happened in 2008? Why was that crisis? Now, we've had financial crisis many times. I mean, since the 1930s, there have been all kinds of crises. But none of those crises and none of those bear markets have brought down the financial system or put it on the brink of going down. So what was special in 2008 that got us to that level of acute risk or acute danger? And of course, there are many different factors, but I would say that one of the key factors was that there was a very large, very highly leveraged space in subprime mortgages that nobody was paying attention to. You would remember that the Fed kept saying subprime is contained. Mm-hmm. So it was not being manipulated. It was not being addressed. The risks were not addressed. It was allowed to run on its own sort of purely fundamental steam. And so what happened there? The entire multi-trillion dollar space was based on one assumption. I mean, all these models, all these pricing models had one assumption. And the assumption was that real estate prices never go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything was priced and leveraged and analyzed and rated on the basis of this assumption. And then that assumption proved to be incorrect. And the moment it proved to be incorrect, the losses were so large that essentially all the major banks were on the brink of bankruptcy. So we're dealing now in a situation where for 35 years, interest rates went down and they're now at their 5,000 year lows or near their 5,000 year lows, which means based on present value formula that the asset prices are at their 5,000 year highs.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Well, you're supposed to buy low and sell high, not the other way around. So if and when this one assumption, which is interest rates, changes, you can expect a massive repricing of everything. So my answer to your question is, what does this all mean? I think this means that ultimately, financial assets, all assets that are priced on cash flows, will lose significant portion of their purchasing power. There's just no way to equalize the system through any other means. Now, that could happen through inflation, because, you know, then the currency in which these claims are denominated is going to lose value, which doesn't necessarily actually mean inflation. It could happen through devaluation as well, which is a form of government-induced instantaneous inflation. Everything is just redenominated. Or it's deflationary bust where there are massive defaults and reorganizations and everything is rescheduled. Now, some people call for a jubilee, debt jubilee. Oh, we'll just forgive all the debts. Well, the problem is that every dollar of debt is somebody's dollar of assets, specifically pension funds, insurance companies, savers, 401k plans.
Yep.
Right? So for every liability, there's an asset. Double entry accounting. That's how it works. So if you're going to forgive all the debts, you're going to wipe out all the assets.
That's right.
I mean, it's as simple as that. So it's not Armageddon scenario. It's a massive financial restructuring that we're going to have to go through, that many, many generations preceding us have gone through. And the world has not ended, but it's a major wealth transfer. And so a lot of people who have money now, or have purchasing power now, is going to lose it. And new people are going to gain it through the opportunities that that type of reorganization brings along. So this is really what it's about. It's about not being a victim and trying to position yourself to protect, preserve, and potentially enhance what you have, the purchasing power that you have, not the dollars, because it doesn't matter how many dollars you have. If people like to be millionaires, they should go to Japan. It takes 100 times less currency to be a millionaire, right? Because it's 100 yen to a dollar. So it's not about the nominal numbers. It's about what you can buy with your money or with your capital.
I got to tell you, I hadn't really thought of it that way. In that 2008, you had a set of financial instruments and derivatives based off the assumption that housing prices would never go down. And look what happened. And now we've got almost infinitely more financial instruments and derivatives based on the idea that interest rates aren't going to go higher.
Correct.
So
they can't go high. I mean, okay, when I say they can't go higher, they can't go higher without major adverse consequences.
Right.
Look at the feds. I mean, look at their budget. The federal budget is you know, income tax collections are $1.6 trillion. Just hold that number in your mind. So this is income tax. The total collections are like $3.2 trillion. So $1.6 trillion. Last fiscal year, 2017, the federal government paid, I don't remember the exact number, but something like $450 billion of interest. That is the highest interest expense. It's the record. It's the highest interest expense ever paid. And guess what? Of course, the government had the highest debt ever, right? But the average interest cost, I mean, interest rate paid on the outstanding liabilities was the lowest ever. So this is like a coiled spring.
Precisely.
$450 billion out of $1.6 trillion of income taxes is already going to interest. And the rates are as low as they've ever been. So if they go up, what? All the taxes are going to go into interest? Then what?
Then what? Exactly. It's magnificent, huge, terrible debt service problem. And Simon, it seems like you and I and a handful of others are about the only ones that are even willing to talk about it. Let's put it that way. You never hear this discussion or this rationalization put on CNBC or Bloomberg.
The asset management industry for whom CNBC and Bloomberg are voices. It's not in their interest to say any of these things. They're in the business of earning fees by having people invest in financial markets.
Yep.
That's right. I mean, so why would they be scaring anybody or giving anybody pause? And the other question is, I mean, what are the alternatives? I mean, when they say everything bubble, and that's the other sort of non sequitur, just like with the uncharted waters, people say, oh, it's the everything bubble. But we see opportunities here.
That's a good point.
But you know, this is cheap, and you notice they always say this is cheap relative to something else.
And they're both
Well,
expensive.
yeah, just less expensive than something else.
Yeah.
So this is grossly overpriced. This is less grossly overpriced. Therefore, it represents value. What kind of value does that represent?
That's a good point. That's a good point. All right. Well, now, Simon, I've got a series, at least so far, of four questions for that were emailed in and from folks that are listening to us as we speak. Oh, and I forgot to mention to you, as we wrap up, I have something called the Final Four, which is just four fun, quick questions that
Sure.
you can usually answer with a word or a sentence. But we'll get to those at the end, but you'll know we're at the end when we get to them. But first, I think the first question that was emailed in ties in pretty well with what we've just been discussing. So I think we'll use that as a segue. Jim must have looked at one of the articles I've written recently. I pulled out one of Nick Laird's old charts that showed the price of gold overlaid with the US debt. And it actually shows, you go back in the 90s, price of gold was going down while the US debt was stagnant to going down with, you know, when they were saying they were running surpluses and that kind of stuff. And then as soon as we get to 2002 or three, the debt level starts to soar, gold goes with it, and everything looks hunky-dory until 2012, obviously. And now price of gold on that chart at least is now way below the debt level. Jim's question, obviously having looked at that chart, it was just simply, do you think the price of gold will one day catch back up? Will that total amount of debt ever matter again to the dollar price of gold?
I used the word purchasing power before. My framework of thinking about this is not about prices, it's about purchasing power. I'll give you an example. So if let's say we had in 2008, between 2007 and 2008 and 2009, March or October 7th through March or 9th, stocks declined by 60%. Gold appreciated by 25%. Nothing exciting, right? I mean, just 25% appreciation over whatever period, the 18-month bear market or whatever it was. It's not less than that, really. It's not that exciting. But in terms of purchasing power, and not consumer price purchasing power, capital purchasing power. In other words, ability to deploy capital at higher yield, at higher returns, right? So if you started in October of 07 with $100 in stocks and $100 in gold, in March of 09, you had 40 cents or $40 in stocks and $125 in gold, which means that the purchasing power of gold, in terms of its capital purchasing power, ability to buy securities, ability to buy businesses, has tripled. So when the price is the price of gold going to ever catch up? The purchasing power of gold, both in terms of probably consumer goods, but more importantly, in terms of capital assets, is going to, I believe, is going to soar because financial assets will end up being devalued and gold is not going to end up being devalued. And potentially it has potential to be revalued upwards substantially. So between those two, and by the way, if you go in the 70s, the same thing happened. Gold went up 10 times, stocks went nowhere. If you go into the 1930s, stocks went down 90%, gold went up 70%. So it happens every time when there's a dislocation of this nature. So yes, I expect that the value of gold in terms of its ability to buy highly profitable investment assets, and potentially other assets like real estate, you know, paintings and other things, beta assets that perform with the stock market, will dramatically increase before this episode is over.
You know, and I think I'll segue down to a listener question that I'm going to kind of rephrase this a little bit into where I think it's headed or where the question is headed. Do you think that because of what you've been discussing, do you think that a reset, a revaluation of the officially recognized price of gold globally is coming? And that a guy you and I both know, Luke Gromen has been talking about this, about how this is the first time in decades, this current time, that a revaluing of the gold price higher would benefit just about every single central bank. Do you think that would be, is that something that's coming? Do you think it would, I mean, is it even necessary?
Well, it is clearly one way. I don't know if it's coming, but I know Luke and I know his theory, and I think it makes a lot of sense. This is exactly what Franklin Roosevelt did in 1934. Now, he preceded that action by nationalizing gold.
Right.
But the gist of the action was the same. The dollar was devalued against gold, so gold price went up from $20 to $35. And of course, everybody who'd sold the gold at $20 to the government was hosed, if you will. The same thing could happen. Well, a similar thing happened in 1970s. But I think it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense because the United States, despite its very bad fiscal position in dollar terms, is the largest holder of, or at least as far as we know, of reserves, of gold reserves, 800,000 tons. So today's value of those gold reserves is, I think, it's like between $300 and $400 billion. So if you devalue it 10 times up, all of a sudden you have $3 or $4 trillion worth of assets, and the Fed has a $4 trillion balance sheet. Oh, you know what? That's not a bad financial position.
Hey,
all of a sudden we've delivered. So yes, it makes a lot of sense. It will not happen. It will, of course, cause major devaluation of the dollar. So I don't think it's going to happen likely. But in an extreme situation, that is a possible and maybe even likely solution.
Yeah,
we got for the central banks to do, because if everything else is devalued, financial assets, then the way to balance the books is to revalue the asset that's not being devalued, which is gold.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. You're wise to reference the confiscation of gold before that happened in the 30s, and how much people really played along with that. But nonetheless, it was that move was made first. A lot of folks, and probably rightfully so, worry that if there is ever a reset like that, that there'd be some kind of at least confiscatory tax if you tried to, you know, those of us that own gold would, you know, benefit from that. Yeah, I mean, what do you think of those ideas?
I mean, it's possible. There are not a lot of people in the United States who own gold, frankly.
Right, right.
So it's not like I don't know that it would be worth the political capital to go on something like that, because not a lot of people own it. It's not a factor really. Most institutions don't own any gold. In fact, the great opportunity in gold, I think, is that it's so massively underowned. And that's because of the narrative. The narrative is that everything is fine and people are acting within that narrative. But if tomorrow it turns out that everything isn't fine, and I don't think fundamentally it is fine at all, then demand for gold can go through the roof, and supply of gold, and I mean physical gold, is even tighter than people think, because people don't think about it. But, you know, yeah, there's $7 trillion worth of gold in the world. And yeah, I don't know how many billions of dollars of New York real estate there is, but if somebody showed up tomorrow with $200 billion to spend in New York City, they can't spend it overnight because the buildings aren't for sale at the moment. Yes, at some point and at some price, the market will find its equilibrium, and that money will get absorbed, but it can't happen overnight. So if tomorrow people decide that they're going to want to buy physical gold, you know, physical gold is a physical gold that investors buy, which is coins and bars, it's a manufactured product. And this product has to be in stock at a dealer where you go buy it. So, and the inventories at the dealers are very low. I mean, because the demand is low. So if there's a spike in demand and everybody wants to buy coins tomorrow, there just won't be any available for a while.
Right,
eventually,
right.
Yes, eventually at the right price, existing holders of gold will be willing to sell it, but not necessarily in the moment. So
right.
I think that there's a great asymmetry in that demand is very low, supply is constrained, and potential demand is very high under particular circumstances.
Yeah.
So that's why gold has this insurance quality of paying out a lot on the low cost investment,
right?
Which is what insurance does, right?
Exactly. All right. Well, then I have that's a good feed into the last question I have in queue. And again, if anybody wants to ask a question of Simon before we wrap up, just type it into the questions tab and it comes to me and I'll pass it along. This, I guess, draws into what your day job, basically, Simon, in being a managing director at Bullion Reserve. There were all these stories, mainly back in 14 and 15. About the Swiss refineries that were running 24/7, you know, and that the gold was getting cleared out of London and it was going to Switzerland, where it was getting recast into 4-9 bars and shipped to Asia. But what Chris points out is we don't hear a lot of those stories so much anymore. Do you know any about that? Is supply still tight? Is it still, you know, is there still this train of gold constantly going east? Do you know much about those stories from your position?
Well, I can tell you this, it ebbs and flows. The demand in China has been very steady. The demand, Russian government has been buying gold like it's gone out of style. I'm sure you're following that.
Indians,
a little less so because the government there has imposed some tariffs. But yes, the Indian demand continues strong. But the Chinese and Russian demand, particularly Russian government demand, has been very, very strong, which just points out why they're doing it. I mean, they're doing it for independence and to protect the purchasing power of their reserves. I mean, that's why they're doing it. And they're not stupid. I mean, people have accused Russians are being accused of a lot of things right now. But nobody has ever said they were stupid.
Right.
So, they're doing this for a reason. It's not as acute as it was a couple of years ago. Generally, demand last year was fairly steady. Physical demand in the U.S. was very low. The U.S. Mint in February, I mean, never mind last year, had the lowest demand for coins in 10 years.
Right.
Nobody wants it. Nobody wants it.
Nobody cares.
Nobody cares. My background and my career has always been in opportunistic, contrarian investments, things that nobody wants. There are no bad assets. There are only bad prices. So when nobody wants it, it usually is an indication that the price has got to be pretty good.
Yeah.
Because the demand is pretty low. So the stories are not as acute as they were. But I can tell you, when I go to buy, you know, several million dollars for investors worth of gold at a clip, directly from the refinery, sometimes it's not available right that day. They have to manufacture the bars. So, you know, $5 million can cause them to have to manufacture the bars. I would suggest that hundreds of millions or billions of dollars flowing in are going to overwhelm that system pretty quickly.
Yeah. And one last question that came in. We've talked a lot about gold, but this question, listener just wants to know if you have any strong feelings about silver one way or the other. It has had a rather tough couple of years too.
Yes, I do have views on silver, but it depends. I mean, from a financial speculative standpoint, silver clearly has tremendous potential. From wealth preservation, physical ownership standpoint, silver is a difficult thing to hold. It's 140 times less valuable than gold by volume. So you can it's about half as dense.
Yeah.
And you know, it's $16 versus $1,300. It takes a lot of silver. So even on a personal level, if you buying a monster box, which is $10,000 worth of coins, I mean, that thing is a beast. I mean, it's heavy and it's big and it's $10,000. So yes, I think silver actually is a perfect emergency currency. So some people own coins with the idea that they think they're going to pay for bread with them, gold coins. That's not very sensible because 1 ounce gold coin is $1,300. I mean, where are you walking around with $1,300 bills to pay for things?
Right.
And that's at today's price. What if it's at $5,000? Now, silver, on the other hand, it's a $20 coin. So, okay, maybe it's a $50 coin. Maybe it's a $100 coin. It's still a reasonable medium of exchange at that price for normal goods and services. So I think silver is a tremendously valuable tool for holding it as a, you know, for an emergency, but as a large wealth preservation and for speculation, but as a large wealth preservation physical holding, it's very expensive to hold and it's not very efficient because it's less dense and much less valuable than gold. It's just an efficiency issue.
Right. Simon, it's just so funny. This is our first chance. I've been doing this for 8 or 9 years now. This is the first chance you and I have had to get a chance to get acquainted. And it's like you're a brother from another mother, my friend. I mean, so many things you've mentioned in the last 40 minutes is stuff that I've talked about here to everybody for years. And that's right there is just one of them. Gold protects your net worth. Silver protects your ability to buy everyday things. So, you know, if it comes down to some type of economic collapse on top of everything else, too.
That's exactly right.
It sure is fun to hear that from you. And I'm just excited that we've had a chance to visit. I know this has been extraordinarily helpful and informative for everybody that's listened. But now we are at the end. And so, as I mentioned earlier, that means you get the final four. Again, this is just four fun, quick questions. You can usually answer it with just like a word or a sentence or something like that. In fact, I should probably find a sponsor for the final four. You know, it should be like, okay. I do this every week. It should be like the final four, of course, brought to you by the good folks at Ford. All right. Anyway, so question number one, for folks that don't know, Bullion Reserve is based in New York City. That's where the corporate offices are. And Simon, of course, lives there. So whenever we get a chance, it's always fun to talk about geographic specific questions. So Simon, yesterday you had this big blizzard come rolling up the Northeast Corridor. What was the best part? What was the best part of the blizzard?
Sitting by the fire at home.
Ah, yes, sir. Were you marinating some ice cubes or anything like that at the same time? Did you have a little adult beverage going too?
May have done. I can't talk out of book, out of school. I may have done.
Fair enough. All right.
Nothing like sitting by the fire, watching the snowflakes come down.
And when it's the middle of March, and you know you're not going to have to look at that crap. Yeah. All right. Second, I haven't been to New York now for 3 or 4 years. Whenever I'd come to New York, you know, you just jump in a cab, right? There's a million of them. But you live there. So when you live there, Simon, do you taxi or do you Uber?
Subway, the fastest way around.
Oh, yeah. I should have had option three on there, shouldn't I?
Subway. That's it. That's the most convenient way to get around New York City, and it costs $2.75 a piece.
Fair enough.
No, I mean the traffic. I mean you can be in a limo. It doesn't matter. It's the traffic. You can spend 30, 40 minutes. So yes, I sometimes use taxis. Rarely I use Ubers, but most of the time I use Subway.
Okay. Question number three. We mentioned the snow is particularly nice to look at when it's the middle of March, and you know you're not going to have to look at it, you know, versus when it's in December or something. But it is the middle of March. I mean, it's almost baseball season. As a New Yorker, are you a Yankee man or a Met man?
Yankee.
I kind of took you for a Yankee guy. Well, plus, you know, it's not that far to get up there. It's the Bronx from where you are.
No. The subway stop is right under my building.
Yeah, can't beat it. All right. Then lastly, living in New York, what was the last Broadway show you saw?
Jesus. I saw a play 2 weeks ago. But I can't remember the name. You stumped me.
But 2 weeks ago is pretty good. I'm happy to hear that you're partaking in the arts, my friend, and getting out.
Sure. Well, that's one of the benefits of living here.
That's right.
I can walk down, see the play, and come by and walk back home.
That's right.
That's the benefit. Yes, it was a play by a playwright whose last name is Albee, and I forgot the name of it.
All right. Have you gone to see Hamilton? Have you seen that in the last couple of years?
No, I have not seen Hamilton. I can't bring myself to pay $1,000
for it. Yeah, I know. The time is
worth that to me.
Right. Before it got to Broadway, when the buzz was just started happening, that was like your one big chance.
Right.
Even in Chicago and LA and all the other places now, it's just off the charts. And so,
yeah, I mean, it's not a question of being able to afford it. It's just a question of repelling at the lack of value.
Right, exactly.
Being repelled by the lack of value.
A lot of money. All right, my friend, thank you so much. Again, Simon Mikhailovich, he's the managing director at bullionreserve.com, Tocqueville Bullion Reserve, and found at bullionreserve.com. Again, the link is on this page. I encourage everybody to check it out. Simon, is there do you have like a minimum? One thing I forgot to ask you, is there a minimum amount of dollars or gold that people need to have to be able to store it with you?
Yes, because of the way it's organized, a partnership, it's a private partnership, so people have to be accredited investors.
Which got it.
It's a $100,000 minimum, and they have to have a net worth of $1 million or annual income of, I think, $200,000 or more.
Okay, that I thought I wanted to make sure that we had that out there so that people know that too. So,
sure.
Anyway, Simon, thank you. I think this has been extraordinarily valuable, and I think we'll have to do it again sometime.
Sure.
And update as we go along. Yeah, thank you. And at this point, we'll shut things down, and I wish you a great rest of your day.
Thank you very much. The same to you. Take care.
All right, everybody out there listening, thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.